I'd like to call to order the December 15th Legislative Commission on Data Practices. Today we are going to spend time learning about the SLED's data program involving mainly higher ed but other agencies as well. And so we've got quite a presentation here. We'll start with that, and then certainly, gentlemen, if you have questions along the way, let me know. Welcome to the committee. If you'll introduce yourselves for the record.
I'm Diane O'Connor. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Office of Higher Education.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Meredith Fergus. I am the SLED's coordinator for OHE, which is the administrative lead on SLED's.
All right, welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, what we've prepared is just some basic background information on SLED's going into a lot of the data access and governance policies for the system. We did also prepare some additional slides for data practices at the Office of Higher Education at the end.
Thank you.
So I know Ms. Larson went through a lot of this in the last or last month's meeting, but we just wanted to kind of bring up what the vision of SLED's was, and it is to assist individuals in identifying viable pathways for individuals in achieving success in education and work. So we're specifically thinking about predictors of long-term individual success, designing targeted improvement strategies, improving data-driven decision-making, and meeting our federal funding requirements. So when we accepted federal funding under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, we did also accept some federal funding requirements to be fulfilled with SLED's data. We currently have three products that come out of the SLED system, which are public reporting websites. The first is the legislatively mandated Getting Prepared report, which is measuring the extent to which public high school graduates need remedial education within their first 2 years after high school. In addition, we have the Graduate Employment Outcomes Tool, which is on the DEED website, which is measuring employment activity of college graduates after college. And then the SLED's mobile analytics website, and that website focuses right now on high school to college transitions, but we'll also be including some developmental education data starting next month. SLED's mobile analytics is also our public site where we include all our data governance and management information publicly. The statutory authority for SLEDS is found under the Minnesota P20 Education Partnership Statute, so Section 126A.70. Specifically, Subdivision 2B states that under the direction of the P20 Partnership, the SLEDS Governance Committee, which is a subset of P20 members, shall improve and expand SLEDS to provide policymakers, education workforce leaders, researchers, and members of the public with data, research, and reports. Specifically, students' educational outcomes, the effectiveness of education and workforce programs, and to evaluate the relationship between education and workforce outcomes. The mandate also notes that we should be able to make the reports accessible to the public and disaggregate by demographics, organization, meaning school, district, or industry, as well as geography. Of course, as always with state agency reports, public information is summary data. It only contains summary data. This is the data that's currently included in SLEDS. So from the Minnesota Department of Education, we do include information that they already have on K-12 enrollment assessment. We purchase results of the ACT exam, advanced placement, and international baccalaureate exams. We do include participation information for adult basic education students. We do include the information from the kindergarten readiness sample of students, as well as early childhood enrollment for those programs that are affiliated with MDE, career and technical education information, and staffing information. From the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, we include post-secondary enrollments and completions from all public and private institutions in the state of Minnesota. And that is a mandated data collection affiliated with receipt of state financial aid. We also include from the U.S. Department of Ed through OHE institutional characteristics, that is information about the colleges in the state of Minnesota. From the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, we do include the unemployment insurance wage detail records, a limited set of employer detail, and then workforce training participant data. In addition, from Pearson, we purchase results of those who pass the GED test who are Minnesota residents, as well as Minnesota public high school graduates who enroll out of state, their enrollment and completion information from the National Student Clearinghouse.
And, If I might, are you linking individual unemployment figures with Social Security numbers in your students, or what data are you getting from DEED specifically?
We get the unemployment insurance wage detail records, which does include the employee's first name, last name, and Social Security number.
And so you then must hold Social Security numbers in your SLED data as well?
Correct. Social okay. Security numbers are also part of the OHE data collection.
Okay.
The purpose of SLEDS is essentially to answer what we call the four Ps. The four Ps were derived out of stakeholder surveys on what research areas the system should focus on to maximize state benefit. And pretty much all stakeholders agree that there are four areas that we should be analyzing and to inform policy. The first is pathways, the movement of individual students between K-12 higher education and workforce. Progress, what are the benchmarks or transition points individuals meet or fail to meet? Predictors, what are the characteristics, patterns, or commonalities that help explain which students achieve successful outcomes and which ones do not? And performance, how well are the overall education workforce systems aligned for individual success? So that is kind of the research agenda that we have kind of been operating under. In terms of data governance, the P20 Education Partnership is designated as the central authority for SLEDS. It is recognized in state law. That committee has rotating chairs that switch between K-12 and higher education, specifically the Chancellor of MNSCU and the President of the University of Minnesota. The membership does include state agencies, K-12 associations, higher education system reps, workforce reps, early childhood reps, legislative members, business representatives, and members of the public. It is a subset of that organization that then forms the SLEDS Governance Committee. There are three committees that P20 established to oversee SLED's work. Governance is our advisory body for policy and kind of procedures. Then we have a research committee, which is advising us on the kind of reports we create and the questions we answer and how we answer them. And then the data advisory committee, which again is focused on data validity, data quality, how we set up the system to maximize the research we can do. The three state agencies do work as a joint partnership for SLEDS. We are the OHE is the administrative league for funding and legal purposes. However, staff from all three agencies serve on all three committees, and there is one designated staff member from each agency who serves as a coordinator, coordinating the day-to-day operations. This is the diagram of how SLEDS operates from the P20 partnership down to the governance committee to the additional committees of research and data. OHE operates as the administrative lead, coordinating with the Minnesota Department of Education, DEED, and Minute Services. The red lines are delineating where our data sharing agreements exist. So we do operate under a web of data sharing agreements, which recognize OHE as the administrative lead, but also govern how we share data, for what purpose, for what time frame, which is compliant with FERPA. SLEDS. We struggled with questions on who would have access to the system, how access would be set up. So we began a process about 3 years ago to try and figure it out. There are 48 states who are building P20 systems, and there are likely 30 different models for how they're doing it. So we kind of had to figure out what works best for Minnesota. Over the last 2.5 years, we put together what is called a data access and management policy. So we garnered a lot of stakeholder feedback, kind of consolidated that into consensus agreements across various issues, and developed our data access and management policy. The purpose of the policy was to support and promote greater understanding and use of SLEDS data, but also to manage SLEDS data access in compliance with data security and data privacy policies and laws. One of the tenets of that policy is the protection of individual privacy.
And what were you doing prior to 2012? If this program was authorized in 06 and you got ARRA money and what, 09? And so what was different? Or were there any issues that prompted this? Or
Madam Chair, the interesting thing is we were doing a lot of administrative setup. We weren't actually doing a lot with data. So it was more about establishing the structures and the policies and what questions we would answer. A lot of that planning work was being done. And a lot of that, all of that was funded under our federal grant.
So what was the first year that you actually produced a report?
2014.
Okay.
It was April of this year, okay. And it was legislative mandated getting prepared report.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. It took a while.
It did take a while.
Okay.
Things seem to take a bit longer than even I think they should, but we worked through the process.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. There are two key sections to the data access and management policy. The first section outlines what we call data access levels. So essentially, agreement on who can have access to which data, and it can, and the levels we believe conform with data privacy law. Apparently, we're restarting anyway. Data privacy law and best practices. Oh, Sally.
I'm sorry.
You know.
I think all of the members, and hopefully they were available for the audience, the presentation, were on screen 11.
Yes. So I guess moving forward, working off the handouts, 11. The other part of the policy is the data access request process. We started with the assumption that no one should have access to SLED's data without clarity around what they're having access to and transparency around who was having access. This kind of transparency and clarity principle applies to state agencies all the way down to public reporting. We wanted to make it very clear who was getting access to the data. So the process outlines by which possible access is approved, by whom, and for what purposes. And it essentially establishes a minimum standard of data of requests for data access. There are five levels of data access. We've deemed level one the most at the top, which is the most restricted, the highest security, and then level five, which would be public information, information that we could put on a website for anyone to see. Each level identifies a targeted user group and purpose, and then level fours require an access review. So the entity must submit a proposal, which is reviewed by the SLED's Research and Data Committee as well as the Governance Committee. And only upon approval do we move into the administrative side and sign data sharing agreements, conduct data security and data privacy training, and those kinds of protocols. Moving on to slide 13 is level one. Level 1A is for Minute staff only. Minute operates as, you know, consolidated IT for OAG, MD, and the SLED system. So level 1A is for operation and management of the system, which includes maintaining accuracy and security of the data. They do have access to all data elements, which would include the personally identifiable information from all sources. The approval for that is done by the commissioners of each state agency and the CIO, and of course they are subject to data security and data privacy training, but more so they can only have access if it's for the purpose of their job. It is very specific that only if SLEDS is their job do they get that access. There's also level 1B. There is one person at each state agency who is also charged with managing the data system, the reporting, including accuracy and security of the data. It's essentially a data validation person. We make sure that the data in SLEDS is linked correctly, that it shows what it should show, and can troubleshoot issues as they come up. We, too, have access for all data elements, including the personally identifiable information, but, again, only for data validation. Again, we are approved by the commissioners and the CIO, and we are subject to data security and data privacy training. And those two levels are operated under an approval form that is signed by each of those entities. Level two, this is the level that where state agency staff gain access to SLEDS, and that purpose is for research and analysis using SLEDS data. So these are the staff that would be producing our legislatively mandated reports. They would be kind of creating the public reporting side of SLEDS, responding to requests from various entities. However, they can only have access to de-identified data. So at this point, all personally identifiable information is removed and replaced with a SLEDS ID. So at no point will they know who the student is or who the individual is. They must, to gain access, they must complete a data access request process. So their proposal, they have to submit a proposal about what they want access to, for what purpose, why, and for how long. It is reviewed by the SLED's Research and Data Committee, which then goes to the three commissioners for an additional review, and then a review by the SLED's Governance Committee. If the three commissioners agree that this is fitting with the purpose of SLEDS and all the basic standards have been met, then it is they are subject to data security and data privacy training, and we operate under a data sharing agreement specific to that research request. Let me just... Oh, apparently we're still having computer issues. Level three... this is very similar to level two. However, this is what we call our partner data providers. So these would be K-12 schools, districts, and colleges. We call them partner data providers in recognition of the fact that OHE and MDE data come from local schools, districts, and colleges. There is also an increasing demand to evaluate and provide better information at the local level, and so we wanted to make sure we were recognizing that use. These entities can also contract with researchers to do research on their behalf, and so we do add the word researcher there as well. The purpose, again, is research and analysis using SLEDS data. It, too, is de-identified data, and there is also a limit on the fields that are available. We also have a secondary product called Secured Reports, which is aggregated information, but the small cells are not suppressed. SLEDS operates under a data suppression policy where if there's an individual cell with fewer than 10 individuals in it, we will not show that information. And so those small cells are not suppressed for this group, but they can only be viewed by that group. So I believe the language in FERPA is with an educational interest, those who have a legitimate educational interest. Also, the population is limited. FERPA only allows us to share with those individuals, current or former students. So if you are a local high school, you can receive information back, but only on students who are or were enrolled at your school. The approval process is similar. They must complete a data access request. The organization executive must approve that, so the local principal, school, or college president. It also goes through the review process with the SLEDS Research and Data Committee, the commissioners, and the governance committee. They, too, are subject to data security, data privacy training, and they, too, must sign a data sharing agreement with OHE. Level four is for external researchers. So these would be entities that are not affiliated with a local school district or the state. This level is largely theoretical at this point. We know there are entities who will be requesting data for us, and so we put in a placeholder for them, but we are not yet implementing this stage of data sharing.
And so, just to be clear then, to this date, the only researchers outside of school districts and agencies are those that are under contract by one of these user groups. And do you know, are they charging, or is there a charge when you disseminate this data under level three?
Madam Chair, actually, to date, we've only approved one data request, and that was MDE. We have in policy that we can charge users. I don't know that, and that is fitting with Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, that we can charge for the IT time involved in that request. I don't know that if it's a local school district or college that we would charge. We haven't made that decision yet. We have in policy that it will be the commissioners who decide upon recommendation.
And we had some discussion at our last meeting about, you know, that you could still have an affiliation with an organization, but using it to develop tests that you would sell, or, right, you know, for a purpose in which you would, organization could benefit financially, maybe develop the newest, latest, greatest way to teach math or whatever. So does your policy about whether you charge or not recognize whether or not somebody has an ability to make a buck off it, or how do you do that?
Madam Chair, we do not at this time, but I'm definitely going to bring that up to our group and how we would handle that. So if the commission has recommendations on how to handle that, I think we'd be open to them.
Well, I think you'll find the legislature struggle with the issue across state systems, whether or not how bulk data should be characterized, how you know, if we should charge, if we should make money on it, if individuals should know that we're making money off their data. Some of those, I think, are emerging issues that I hope the legislature at some point. So I was just curious. We had MDE testify at our meeting that they are not allowed to, according to state law. So we have Department of Public Safety that says they can, according to state law. So we have various interpretations of this standard across the agencies. So I was just curious.
In just working through data privacy issues with OHE, MDE, and DEED, I don't know that we would be comfortable essentially selling data. So I think that's probably where we would err on MDE's side of not doing it. But also the SLED data access policy says that any data request must be for research beneficial to the state. And so if it were a strictly a commercial interest, I don't know that we could call that beneficial to the state. I think it would have to meet a higher standard of what the state would receive out of it other than just financial gain.
Well, if you had a company that was going to develop a test that was required by the state, I can see that being construed as a benefit to the state if you were going to go back to a basic skills test or, you know, some other kind of required instrument, I think is the terminology in education. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the definition is the benefit to the state could be interpreted pretty broadly.
Correct.
So.
After level.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And speaking of being interpreted broadly, I'm concerned what the definition of educational purposes are. You stated that, you know, for purposes of research and so forth, if there's an educational purpose, then it's allowed. Do you have a definition for educational purposes?
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, we typically rely on the FERPA language, which is limited to research data sharing to improve curriculum or instruction, to improve instruction, evaluation or administration of education programs, and I'm trying to think of our lawyers in the room. What am I missing? There are very strict standards in FERPA on what we can and can't do with data sharing. So they do define it under federal law.
Right. Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Last year, you know, you've probably heard of this Timber J bill that basically said if you're contracting with the government, then those contracts with those private entities would have to be subject to Minnesota data practices law. And so the contracts that you have currently, are those contracts, have they been updated, did they already contain this, you know, something in the contract stating that you are subject to Minnesota law on this? Or?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, we currently only have one contractor for the SLED system, and yes, it is updated in their contract.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Okay, thank you. Continue. Oh, we're back up.
We are, Madam Chair. The final level is, of course, level 5, and this is for public information and reporting, information sharing. It only includes summary-level data and reports for which the small cell sizes would be suppressed. Approval at this is that there is an agency review to ensure that the reports are compliant with data practices as well as best practices in sharing data, and there is a SLED stakeholder review for data quality. This is where our three current products would fall under. They are public reporting. And they are very cool products, so if you want to check them out. Next, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the actual request process so you know the level of detail we go into when reviewing requests. These are the types of requests we anticipated when the system were up. The three state agencies would be making requests. We do anticipate requests from colleges, K-12 schools, and districts. Eventually, we expect external requests, and then our public requests were our primary product. There are guidelines for conducting research using SLEDs, and actually all of our requests are reviewed to see how well they fit with these guidelines. SLED's research must involve analysis of transitions between systems or between providers within a system. The SLED system is one of the few data systems that allows a lot of data across providers as well as across K-12 higher ed and workforce that state agencies alone cannot do. The research conducted using SLEDs must align with the state priorities. The current priorities we have are the four Ps as well as our various legislative language. There is a large amount of language in the higher education workforce data about what we, or workforce law about what we should be reporting on. So that's another source we gain from. It must have the potential to make a definite contribution to contributing state agencies and partner data providers. We struggled with the definite contribution language, as in various stakeholders can interpret their own research as having a contribution. So we wanted to make sure that it was consensus agreement on that it has a potential to make a contribution. It must use sound research design and have the potential for completion. It must also comply with ethical standards, all regulations set forth in state and federal law, particularly as they pertain to privacy of data on individuals. Numbers 4 and 5 are an absolute. They have to meet those criteria before they're ever approved. To gain access to the SLED system, all requesters, including state agencies, must submit a completed request, which includes contact information, project information. It is reviewed by the SLED's coordinators to ensure it's complete, and at this time we do estimate how much it will cost in terms of IT time and time frame so that the requesters are well aware that if we should charge them, what we would charge them, and how long it will take to fulfill their request. At this point, they have the ability to withdraw it if they don't agree with either those costs or time frames. Then it is reviewed by the SLED's Research and Data Committee, who rate the proposal based on established guidelines. They have a scoring rubric that they use. And they recommend it for approval or denial. We have struggled with the question of whether we can deny requests for access to SLED's data. And so what we've been operating under is that if a requester should not meet the minimum standards for access, that we will ask them to go back and revise their request. Unless, of course, they are trying to violate data privacy law or some absolute standard that has to be maintained, at which point, deny. The final approval, there's a consensus response by the three commissioners to the requester. There's a review by the SLED's Governance Committee. They must complete data security, data privacy training, and have a signed data sharing agreement before any data is transferred. Upon completion of the research, they must submit a copy of their research findings 30 days prior to publication to the SLED's coordinators. They are also subject to data destruction under FERPA, meaning that you can only have access to data for a limited time period. Upon completion of the study or the date specified in the data sharing agreement, the data must be destroyed, and they must send written confirmation of that data destruction to a SLED's coordinator or OHE. Right. We anticipate it takes 6 to 8 weeks for the initial review and 4 to 6 months for the full process. We'd prefer to go slower to ensure that we're not hurriedly making a mistake along the way. We want to take our time in reviewing these requests. In terms of data security, as I mentioned before, we are under consolidated IT with the Department of Education and OHE and SLEDS. And so rather than fulfill the slide with technical jargon, these are the standards. We ensure appropriate administrative, technical, and physical safeguards. We limit access based on data access levels to approved individuals, so role-based access. We assign a unique SLEDS ID to each individual so that they cannot be identified and that we do not have to provide personally identifiable information outside of SLEDS. We do mask the data to ensure confidentiality of persons by suppressing small cell sizes. We also maintain an access list of all personnel with access to SLEDS, and we provide staff training and enforcement of the code of conduct in all IT-related manners for all state agency employees.
And do you keep an audit trail of who accesses the information?
We do.
Are any additional questions on the SLEDS? So help me out here. When you going back to, you list all these, we're talking about preschool programs, et cetera, are we moving toward a position where an individual's entire educational history ends up in some government database? I was a little surprised at the preschool stuff, so help a non-education person understand why we would want to, in my vernacular, track students.
Madam Chair, we do, SLED's data will contain the entire educational history of an individual to the extent that we can link that information across systems. The focus on early childhood programming is largely about kindergarten readiness and that critical K through 3 time period. We know that if students aren't on track by grade 5, that they will likely remain behind educationally through high school graduation and into college. So that early childhood component, be it preschool through grade 3 or even grade 5, is a critical time period for educational preparation. And so because we know that it matters, we did come to the conclusion that that data would provide a strong basis for high school to college transitions research, as well as simple research on high school graduation. So that was our rationale for that.
So how do you stay out of the system if you are a parent and you don't want your child's information? How would you even know that the state is, again, using my term, tracking your student for research purposes?
Madam Chair, this is probably one of the areas we've struggled with the most. Most of the data that's collected at MDE and OAG is state-mandated data collection. So we do not allow the opt-out for students and parents. That is not to say we don't want to. It's that we have not figured out a way to do it effectively to this point. For example, OAG data, the mandated data collection is for colleges to report on all students they enroll if the college accepts state financial aid or participates in state financial aid programming. So for a student who opts out at even the college level to share their data, it is still transmitted to OAG. We've spent many, many, many hours discussing how we would implement an opt-out flag for students in higher education. And the questions we struggled with were that if a student opts out in year one of college, if a student does not opt out of sharing their data in year one or year two, but does in year three, is the year three preference retroactive to year one and two, which has already been loaded into SLEDS? If the student then chooses not to opt out in year four, does that trump the year three opt-out preference? If a student in a single year enrolls in two colleges and opts out at College A but not at College B, which should the state take into account? Do we suppress one record but not the other? If a student, does the opt-out apply across providers? So if there's an opt-out preference in higher education, would that apply to the K-12 data in SLEDS? So those are the kind of the questions we struggled with in implementing. We're still struggling with them. We would like to figure out a way to do it, but there's not clear direction on how we would implement the opt-out preferences.
Well, why wouldn't you rely on the data subject's preference? When they opt out, they could say, opt out, yank my, you know, pre-K through whatever, 20, I don't know, whatever years. I mean, I don't know. Why should it be your decision? Why couldn't the data subject control the destiny of their data?
Madam Chair, are you, let me just make sure I'm understanding. Are you suggesting that we could possibly add some preferential questions to the opt-out notification where they specify kind of the system and the term for the opt-out?
Yes.
We have not discussed that. I can certainly take that option back to our group. It would mean that it would need to go in all opt-out preferences for every college in the college and district in the state, as well as every school and district within the state, as well as every public and private college in the state.
Explain that more. I mean, if, from my perspective, if I've got a unique identifier and or a social security number, why couldn't the data on that individual be purged from the system altogether?
Madam Chair, it can be. The opt-out preference is typically collected at the local level. The school and district communicates the data privacy notification or the Tennyson warning to the student or parent, and that is the point at which the opt-out preference would be collected. So that is the point where we'd have to know what exactly they were opting out of and for what time period. Once we have that information, we could definitely adapt the system to do that. The other concern we would have...
Because, I mean, I know when the authority for this was given... And certainly there could have been subsequent changes to the law, but one of the important precepts about this was that parents and or students, if they were of age, would have control of whether or not they were their data was put through this process. And I'm concerned that maybe that standard, hopefully the system's able to do that, because if we get a bill to do it and comes out with a $100 million fiscal note or something to adapt the system, you know, that's one way to make things hard around here. But, I mean, it seems that you've been very thorough in many of your standards that you've presented to the committee, but I'm not hearing... I mean, I would have liked to have that have been at the top of the list as far as rights of the data subject and be just as robust as the other elements of your program appear to be.
Understood, Madam Chair. The other thing we struggle with is that we know that SLEDS was created to inform policy for the state. So we do have concerns about the extent to which opting a group of students or parents or allowing a group of students or parents to opt out may undermine some of that research should there be a significant number of students or parents who do that. The prime example is a student who receives state financial aid. Given that the state is providing essentially cash assistance to that student to attend post-secondary education, there is some benefit to the state in knowing whether that student graduated from college. So that would be a prime example of some of the research we do.
And certainly I understand that, but I also heard that if a facility received state or federal funding, that they were required to participate in whole. So you probably have students that aren't even receiving any direct student aid in which their student records are being loaded into the system, probably without their knowledge or consent, I'm guessing.
Madam Chair, we did ask, in terms of higher education, we did ask all colleges and universities, including Minsky and the University of Minnesota, to update their data privacy notifications and Tennyson warnings to include SLEDS starting about 5 years ago. So we did take that step for sure.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I always approach this issue that individual citizens should have some a greater degree of autonomy about the information that's collected on them, and they should have some control somewhere, and making a condition of whether one gets student aid or not should not be an indicator of records that, although may be protected, somehow are used as a lever in order to get grants and aids and other things, and that they should have it. I know that this is probably not, well, it's an appropriate venue to talk about, but it might be something that the legislature has to address rather than a government agency. The one question I did have is, maybe you can help me, because didn't you say that public school records or your elementary through 12th grade records would continue forward into the higher education world? I just want to know, whatever happens to those detention records that I was threatened with all the time? You know, you're going to have to go to detention, and that record is going to follow you the rest of your life. And I just want to know, is that true?
Senator Limmer, we've all read those reports. Do you know that?
Never mind. No, I was just wondering, whatever happens to the detention records of kids in elementary school or high school?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I actually have no clue, but I can tell you they're not in SLEDS.
All right. Well, then I've told my children the right thing.
All right. So, Ms. Fergus, I'm still struggling with some components of this. Can you, if somebody goes in and files for unemployment, does DEED push that data to you, or do you request it only on a limited set of individuals, or how is the, I mean, education data is one thing, where you're working, how much you're being paid, if you're on unemployment, that just seems, you know, it's a big step. So how does the data subject know, or even do they? And do you only collect those that you tag, or are you getting all of the unemployment and wage data from Deed and then sorting it?
Madam Chair, we actually receive the quarterly wage detail records, so we don't receive information on unemployment insurance benefit recipients. That is the one thing. We do receive the quarterly wage records, which is the data on all employees at all companies subject to unemployment insurance. The entire data file is loaded into SLEDS. There's no filtering done. So it is all workers in Minnesota subject to UI. So, and that is under the new statutory authority that was granted 2 years ago.
See, I missed that. So you're telling me that every single worker in the state of Minnesota that works for a company that's subject to unemployment insurance, their Social Security numbers and names are in the SLEDS data?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Wow. That doesn't make me feel very good. I don't know about anybody else at this table, but would your system have the ability to flag particular Social Security numbers and only take those of a certain age or, in other words, that you make the request for the individuals that are in your system?
Madam Chair, we could not filter on age. Deed does not collect a date of birth, so we could not do any filtering on age. The sharing to do the second option, which would be to only request those students with an education record to also pull in their quarterly wage detail record, would mean that OHE and MD would need to submit a complete list of all students in the state of Minnesota to Deed to do the matching. Under SLEDS, we're doing the matching in the secured environment, and so we saw that as a better preference in terms of data management, rather than sharing a full list of all students in the state with Deed. Deed and FERPA would require that Deed be a subcontractor should we do that. So we'd have to change kind of our administrative structure to do option two.
Okay, so if you're just Joe the Plumber, I like Joe the Plumber, I'll use him. Okay, so you're Joe the Plumber in Minnesota, and you're just out there doing your job. How do you or could you in any way, shape, or form make sure that your work data does not end up in SLEDS if you were by any chance so aware of things to figure out that it was actually being sent to SLEDS?
Madam Chair, I'd have to check with legal at Deed. Who is not here today? But I can check with them to see what if there are opt-out provisions within the unemployment insurance records. I do not know of any, though. So I do not know that Joe the Plumber would be aware that, number one, that Deed collects his quarterly wage detail records, or that they are sharing them for research purposes, including SLEDS. So, but I can confirm with Deed on that.
Okay, maybe I can look at it this way. It seems like you are amassing a database on virtually every citizen in the state of Minnesota in order to study educational trends, which most people, I mean, I know that people have second careers and go back to college, but this massive amount of data that you're taking in, your goals seem to concentrate more on the, well, P20, under 25 crowd, if you will. So I'm just wondering, what's the benefit of that massive amount of data collection of people far into their career? I mean, please tell me you don't have my educational records in your program. I mean, given that it's so new.
Madam Chair, I actually don't know if we have your education records. I would doubt it. But then again, we don't have the individual student information at my access level to be able to tell that.
But, I mean, do you have graduates in the state of Minnesota going back to the 70s? I mean, it looks like you only have 3 or 4 years that you put in so far. So,
for K-12 records, it's 1998 is the starting point for K-12.
So it's any child that was enrolled in a Minnesota school since 1998?
Public school, yes, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm feeling worse and worse as we go on here. Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Let me give you an example. Could Joe the plumber, who may be working for a number of years, if you had a, if the higher education system had a new education program or a degree of some sort, do they ever sell that list to a school so that a school could advertise to Joe the plumber that a new educational opportunity might be available to him?
Madam Chair, Senator Lieberman, I don't believe so, no.
You don't no. sell the list at all?
No.
All right. Can a subject like the chair, could she request any available record that you hold on her? Could an individual, the subject, request the file and see if it's accurate or not?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator, yes. We do have a protocol for conforming with Chapter 13 requests for individuals to inspect their records. Yes.
And, Madam Chair, if one would find the data incorrect, can they have it have the improper data expunged from that record?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, absolutely. We would conform with that right under Chapter 13.
And how would they prove
Senator
that their record is incorrect? Or do you would you be the arbiter of that judgment? Or would you simply take it on face value that the subject subject's knowledge of their own record is accurate or not?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, we have not gone through that process. I think we'd have to work through some of the details on how we do it. We'd certainly be open, though, to ensuring that the individual, if they felt the information was in error, and working with their local educational districts to correct it as needed, yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Just for discussion purposes, this kind of reminds me of when you have to correct some information on a credit report. And if anyone has ever done that, sometimes it's very difficult to do. And I don't know, you know, since we don't have a structure or a method to do that, I would hate to have a knowledge that someone's education record may be inaccurate, and upon request, we don't have a system to adequately address it. You know, I work in the real estate business, and we sometimes find credit reports of potential buyers that have inaccurate data on a credit report, and it denies them, at least for the moment, the opportunity to take a or to purchase a property that is suddenly up on the market, and now it will soon go away, or someone else will get to that same opportunity. I could see it happening if one had an education record that somehow got out that was inaccurate and a person couldn't get a job that was suddenly available. Right. I don't know if that information is shared in that manner, but, you know, I could – are there any requests like national defense entities, federal government jobs that come to you that seek information or want to look at that information that you have in order to do a background – survey of a potential employee?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, no, we have not received any requests like that. In addition, it's actually probably easier for us to change the record within the state system, but given that the records originate from a local provider, we would want to ensure that we're working with the local provider to ensure corrections are done there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have to bifurcate that request or that data kind of correction process.
Madam Chair, would the local provider of that information, would that be a school district or another education system? Is that what you mean by a local provider?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Senator Lamer, yes. Though we also purchase data from such as ACT and College Board, and if those data elements were in error, I'm not exactly sure how we could get them to correct them, given that they are kind of outside entities. But we would definitely work with the student or individual to try and do that. Yes.
Right.
So, Ms. Fergus, when a student was in school in the 90s and provided information in their Tennyson warning, you know, I'd be curious to see what Tennyson warnings were given out to parents of the students of the records that you now hold from decades ago. Are you relying on the authority in the current law that you can have access to all this without any warning or notice to parents or data subjects?
Madam Chair, the data in question would be MDE data, and so I'd likely defer that question to their legal counsel to respond. So I can have them get back to you on that. I do not know enough about what their data privacy notifications were for MDE in 1998 going forward.
Right, and so if a data subject wanted to purge their information from your system, what would they do?
Madam Chair, at this time, we do not have a process for that.
Do you believe that a data subject would have that right?
Madam Chair, we would likely consult with IPAD and the Department of Admin on that response. I don't know that we have enough information at this time to answer.
All right. Any other questions on the SLEDs? Otherwise, we'll go to the OHE data section. And right now, I have a quorum at the table, so would you like to move the minutes, Senator Dibble, of the December 15th and 25th minutes? Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Yay, we got the minutes approved for once. All right, if you'd continue, please.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Let me just fast forward through our PowerPoint to get to the OHE section. OHE data, we do define educational data in the same scope that the Department of Education did. So just a reminder of that scope. The purposes of collecting data for OHE, OHE is a state educational authority under FERPA. And we collect data for three primary purposes: program administration, program evaluation and planning, and policy research and analysis. We take care only to collect the data we need to support our programs and the requirements of our statute. And we do have an OHE Data Advisory Committee. This is a committee of institutional representatives charged with advising the commissioner on the collection of data from colleges, which would cover both institutional data and student-level data. The OHE has statutes regarding educational data and the collection of educational data in multiple areas under our statutory duties, under the cooperation of institutions, under our state financial aid mandated data collection. All educational data is considered private data, as well as we collect data in our private post-secondary registration and licensing statutes. There are data collection requirements there. We do have a balance between the institutional burden of compiling aggregated data with the necessity of collecting the individual student record. So for every data request we do consider, is this something we can collect summary data on to fulfill our need, or is this something we need individual level records on? So we have that debate with every data request. In terms of student data, we do collect application, funds payment, outcomes, educational activity, and compliance and auditing data related to financial aid programs. Student enrollment, we include registration information and demographic information on students. For student completion, we collect instances where individuals are awarded certificates or degrees in the state of Minnesota. And then we have a college prep program internal to OHE called Get Ready, and we collect participant enrollment activity and outcome data on those students. Those are our student-level data collections. Our institutional-level data collections include the private registration and licensure. So these are the kind of financial and other administrative or information that's required to be licensed to operate in the state of Minnesota as a private college. We also collect aggregated student information on financial aid programming. We also include funded programs, participant information and outcomes. So from our competitive grant programs, they do have data reporting requirements, but those are typically summary data at the program level. And then we do collect some institutional data in terms of policies, procedures, and compliance with state law in terms of the administration of our state-funded programs. The larger set of institutional data is actually just collected from the U.S. Department of Education, who mandates that data be provided by colleges. So it's a public use data set that we then download, which would include staffing, financing, basic degree offerings. So we don't have to collect that information. data sharing. As a state educational authority, we actually operate under a series of data sharing agreements with every college and university in the state of Minnesota, as well as the programs we fund. We do have agreements with K-12 schools and districts in terms of the Get Ready program, as well as the FAFSA completion initiative, where we can let high schools know which of their students have completed the FAFSA in preparation for college. We do also provide college prep programs with that FAFSA completion data under U.S. Department of Education guidance. We have data sharing agreements with the institutions for enrollment, completion, SLEDS, and Get Ready programming, as well as program participation agreements for each of our financial aid programs. From the U.S. Department of Education, we receive FAFSA application data, and that is under a program participation agreement with them. For Minnesota state agencies, such
as... Excuse me, just a minute. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two kids in college, so you got all my data. You got it all. And so...
Nothing we don't know about.
My question, it just happened upon me, is, well, two things, actually. First of all, FAFSA is required for anyone going to college. Is that correct?
Ms. Ferguson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, no. It is only required if you would like to be eligible for federal or state financial aid.
Okay. Then my second question is...
So all but the rich children.
Yeah, exactly. So my next question is, and I know there are a lot of foreign students that come this way, and I know a lot of them get scholarships to come here, but I can't think that they're filling out a FAFSA because they wouldn't have a U.S. tax form to fill out, return. How are, just, are those, is the fund, they, do they get state or federal funding to come here, and if so, how is that determined?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, largely they do not. They must demonstrate before they're allowed a student visa that they have financial resources to pay for their higher education and live in the United States. That is a requirement of their student visa. There is state and federal financial aid eligibility, but it is limited to eligible non-citizens, so those with a certain type of permanent residency. And so that is a very specific group, but it's largely not the international student you speak of.
Okay. Thanks.
Anything else? Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, we do also have data sharing agreements with a variety of state agencies, and those are largely around verification of eligibility for financial aid and funds collection. We also have research-based agreements, and those tend to be project-specific. That is where our SLEDS agreements would fall under. We also have agreements to do financial aid research, as well as evaluation and research under a consortia agreement. So those are our research-specific data sharing projects. Also, in terms of data security, we have similar provisions, given we have consolidated IT, appropriate administrative, technical, physical safeguards, role-based access. We do use secure data transfers and maintain the personal access list. We do mask our data, ensure confidentiality of all persons, and there is staff training and enforcement of the code of conduct in all IT-related matters.
I have a question. Do you, I'm thinking of an example, how do, does HIPAA interface at all with you in that there are certain charter schools that cater to populations with particular medical conditions? Does that factor into this at all? I'm thinking of sober schools, and just by virtue of the fact that identifying a child as being attending them would in turn disclose a medical condition?
Madam Chair, to date, OHE does not have any data sharing agreements with those types of schools. So as of yet, no.
So you're not doing charter schools. So when you say all public schools except charter schools, or?
Madam Chair, the schools actually opt in on if they want to share data. We haven't initiated data sharing agreements for the FAFSA completion initiative. That would be the largest program. The Get Ready school agreements are limited to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Brooklyn Center only, and so they're very limited.
No, I'm back on SLEDS in general. I mean, are you collecting from the charter schools, or I'm just curious if there's a special designation for those kids that give them a higher level of protection?
Madam Chair, I would need to consult with MDE Legal Counsel because SLEDS would have that data to the extent that it's collected by MDE. so I would need to double check with them on
that.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm guessing these kids are in your system, but if you're just disclosing, you know, directory information, you know, I'm just...
Sorry, Madam Chair, I do not have
okay.
any answer.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the last page that we are covering, could you tell me what the standard protocols for WAN, is it WAN, WAN, data transfer?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Fergus.
Lemmer. I could not know, but I could definitely get the IT person to do that.
Well, I'm sure it's probably 3 inches thick, but where could I get a copy of the standard protocols for this reference?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair, Senator Wilmer, I'll put in a request to our CIO to do that.
Could you have it sent to my office?
Oh, certainly.
Senator Wilmer, careful what you ask for.
I know.
I'll be curious to find out how many pages that is.
Well, I'm sure we made reference in the, at least the written form, but there was no verbal reference to it. And so I think they're trying to assure us that they're following some type of standard protocol, and I don't know what that standard protocol is, and I would just like to get a little more familiar with it.
All right. Thank you. Any additional questions? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just Senator Lemmer, I assume it just is referring to some form of encryption so that someone can't snatch the data out of the air as it makes its way through across the office. But, yeah, it'd be interesting to understand.
Thank you. All right, let's see if there's anybody in the audience that would like to testify in any of these matters. Raise your hand. Looks like what Mr. Gemberling would like to share his thoughts. Anybody else? Okay. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Gemberling, if you'll state your name for the record, please.
You bet, Madam Chair. Don Gemberling. I think today I'm here in a dual role for resident historian, institutional memory. That's the one role. The other role is from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, the transparency people. So what I heard today was a series of pieces of information that make me troubled, for lack of a better word. Okay. And the troubling aspects appear kind of in two general areas. When you started talking about protecting personal data back in the 70s, okay, you created a system in statute to do that. Its focus was primarily on protecting personal data from collection by the government and by sharing by the government. Okay, that was the focus in those days. Okay. And as a matter of fact, one of the, for lack of a better word, outcomes of that was to make the kind of thing you've heard about today very difficult to do. Okay? So back when I worked for the state, I sat in all kinds of meetings with, not these people, but their predecessors, talking about how to do this when the Data Practices Act made it very hard to do. Okay? And frankly, often the response was, we either can't do it, or my recommendation was almost always, to the extent that federal law allows it, go to the legislature and ask for specific authority. Okay? So, one of the things you heard today is the Tennyson Warning focuses on giving people information so they can make an informed decision about whether or not they want to give data to the government. Okay? They can only make that informed decision if they get a full and adequate Tennyson Warning. And what you'll see when you start, if you start looking at them in detail, is over the years they've acquired a boilerplate kind of way of doing things. And at the end of the description of uses and disseminations of data, you'll find the following. And we'll use and disseminate this data consistent with what law allows us to use and disseminate. Now that doesn't tell me anything. Unless I want to research all of Minnesota statutes and all of federal law, okay? So that in itself, I understand why agencies do that, because they look upon the Tennyson Warning as an extreme burden and a limitation on their authority. But as you can see, what it does is it allows them to escape the real purpose of the tennis morning. You were, Madam Chair, you were quite interested in collection of data by deed that ends up in this massive database. Well, that's another aspect of the how do you protect privacy problem, because what they're really doing is deed is collecting that data from employers, largely from private sector. The private sector has no requirement to give people tennis warnings, okay? And once the private sector has that data, if the heavy hand of the state of Minnesota comes down and says, thou shalt give us this data, or you will be in trouble with the sheriff at deed, then guess what? The employer is going to provide the data. And that will include things like people's Social Security numbers. One of the old issues that's floated around is in the 70s, there was much focus on how to handle Social Security numbers because they were the only unique identifier that we all had if we were adults, okay? Now, the federal government changed that late in the 80s or sometime in the 80s by requiring that kids have Social Security numbers, okay? So there was concern that if you're going to have a universal personal identifier, which is something that this country, unlike the rest of the world, doesn't like to do, which has a lot to do with our history, then how do you make sure it's not abused, okay? Well, when the feds passed their Privacy Act in 1974, which, by the way, is largely ineffective, but they put a strange provision in it. They put in a provision that said, basically, although the whole rest of this statute only applies to the federal government, we're going to limit the collection of Social Security numbers by state and local government. And so they put in limitations on what Social Security numbers could be used for. Now, the limitations essentially were three general ones: driver's license, motor vehicle, tax, and employment kinds of things. But then they also put in the usual and any other purpose authorized by federal law. Okay, so then you have to go spend a lot of time looking at federal statutes. But clearly one of the places where they said, by incompletion, you can't collect Social Security numbers is to use as a personal identifier in educational systems. Okay? How many of you went to the University of Minnesota back in the 70s, 80s, or 90s? Were you asked to provide your Social Security number?
I'm sure I was.
That's because it was their student ID number. Were you told that pursuant to the Federal Privacy Act of 1974 that you were not required to provide that number?
Senator Dibble.
I'm sure I wasn't.
You were supposed to, okay? Because in addition to limiting the collection of the Social Security number, the feds also said you cannot deny, and this is a quote, you cannot deny any individual any right, benefit, or privilege provided by law, including an education, if that individual refuses to provide the Social Security number unless the number is mandated to be collected. So you can't not give the Department of Revenue your Social Security number because that's mandated by law. Okay? So at some point in my career in state government, I started meeting with education types and finding out, and this is both higher education and school district, that they recognize the need for a universal personal identifier for things like the student accounting system, and guess what they collect? The Social Security number. Okay? And I would say to them, as gently as possible, I think what you're doing is a violation of federal law. And they would say to me, well, you know, we have all this money invested in it. We've built this whole system, and now you're telling us we can't do it. And the most creative argument I found was one from the Department of Education, and frankly, I don't know if they still do this, is, well, this number is not the Social Security number. Well, why isn't it? Well, because attached to the front of the number is the number of the school district at which the student originally enrolled. Okay? Then the rest of the number is the Social Security number. Okay? And I thought, you know, that's really creative, but you're begging the issue. It's still the Social Security number, even though you put four digits or three digits or whatever in front of it. So that whole area of privacy protection then goes away, okay? Because you then end up, as the chair has observed, with the potential for a system that does exactly what people were trying to not do in the 70s, which is to have a giant database that links a kid, for all intents and purposes, a kid and adult, from womb to tomb using the Social Security number. So, now, whether or not you can do anything to change that at this stage of the game, I don't know, but you should be aware that's what's happening, and that's what's happened, okay? And it's the kind of thing where at least those of us who tried to say, you sure you want to do this, and essentially were ignored, get kind of frustrated about, okay? You know, I didn't go to school here, so I'm free. all my stuff is in Montana, and God knows what they do in Montana. So the other aspect of this that, again, when you did privacy protection in the 70s, part of what you did was to try and limit collection of data on people and use and dissemination of that data. And so in the Minnesota Data Practices Act, you'll find language that says you should only collect data if that collection is necessary to carry out programs mandated by the state or federal government. Okay? In the Data Practices Act, you'll find language that says you should only use and disseminate private or confidential data if that use and dissemination is authorized by the legislature or the federal government. Okay? So I started observing another new phenomenon, which is I would hear an agency was doing something, or they would come to me and say, can we do this? And I would say, well, what's your statutory authority to do this? There's no federal thing here in this example. Well, we're going to use a data sharing agreement. Well, what's a data sharing agreement? Well, we're going to agree with this department over here that they'll share their data with us and we'll share their data with them. And it's all always for a good purpose. I don't want to say it's not for a good purpose. But there's no statutory authority to do so. Okay? And as you will look at what you've seen today, this stuff is full of data sharing agreements. Okay? Now, we then circle back to the Tennyson warning. Does the Tennyson warning say, well, anytime we want to sign a data sharing agreement with anybody, you should know that we'll share the data with anybody we sign the agreement with? How does that protect my ability to make an informed decision about whether or not I give my personal data? And the answer is, it doesn't. Okay? Now, the other thing I noticed in what you heard today was, and this is largely from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information perspective, somewhere in here there's all kinds of statements about at some level all of this data becomes de-identified, or not, some of it does. And I'm not sure if the terms de-identified and summary data are used interchangeably. Let's go back to what the legislature decided long ago. One of the things you wanted to make sure did not happen with government information was that it be kind of in a fortress so that people who really wanted to figure out what the government was doing and how it was spending our money would not be able to have access to it. And that was largely a question of data on people when that data had been decreed to be not public. Okay? So you put into the Data Practices Act a summary data provision that says basically two things. Anybody can come to any government agency and say, I would like you to prepare some summary data for me. Okay? And I'm willing to pay for it. And some preparing summary data means de-identifying the data if it's data that's on individuals that's not public. I'm willing to pay for you to do that. I'm willing to sign a non-disclosure agreement that makes me liable if I misuse the data. And then the Data Practices Act suggests that agency ought to do it. It doesn't have to do it, but that's a way of rewarding research. Okay? The second aspect of the summary data provision says, well, maybe this person can't afford to pay for it. And the Data Practices Act and its rules actually say that in a situation like that, if you can give this researcher or the member of the public access to the data, and they remove the personal identifiers, subject to a non-disclosure agreement, subject to indemnification clauses, whatever. Okay? So when I look at these protocols and I see all of these levels of people having and hoops that people have to jump through to get access to data that by definition is public, I don't understand why that is. Okay? And part of that is a strange phenomenon that's come up in about the last 5 years. We're struggling with a confusion between two different concepts. The first concept is called transparency. I taught a class at the U a couple of years ago, and the class was privacy and transparency. And we spent a whole class session talking about what do we mean by transparency. And what I think the common and ordinary meaning is, because transparency has become the big word, is transparency in practical terms means the more stuff you put on a website, the more transparent you are. Okay? And that's a good. Okay? But that doesn't have anything to do with access to public data under the Data Practices Act. Because access to public data under the Data Practices Act is under your control because of what you've mandated by way of data classifications. And it also says the public doesn't have to go to a state agency and take what it's willing to give them. They're entitled to access to public data. Okay? So, and I see that kind of confusion here. You know, because we put a lot of stuff on our website, that means we're transparent. That means we're in compliance with the Data Practices Act. But that's not what the Data Practices Act says. Particularly in the case of, you know, the person, be they a media person or a private researcher or whoever they are, who's willing to do the work to look at data in summary fashion to figure out what is happening. Okay? And, you know, some of the mandates you put in the statute say things like make the data available to the public. Well, having to get approval at several levels to get public data just is not what I understand you meant when you enacted the public access provisions of the Data Practices Act. So, I know you're not going to have a lot more meetings, but I, you know, your task, every time I come to one of these sessions, I appreciate the fact that commission has been created, but the task before you just becomes more daunting, because my understanding of reality and what I keep hearing is the reality of what's going on out there is absolutely amazing. Okay, I wasn't here for the session on health plan data that you had, but as I told you,
that actually was Chair Lesch's committee Monday afternoon, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But as I said to the chair, you know, I can't tell you how many hours that I spent when I worked for state government working extra hours to make sure a report mandated by the legislature was delivered on time. And I probably did that in part because I felt it was my professional responsibility, but I also worked for people who said, you know, this is the image of our agency. We're going to do this on time. So to hear that a state agency just basically blows off your deadlines is absolutely amazing to me. Okay?
You have to repeat that.
So well, and you know, let me put it this way. We have some terminology that I learned growing up in Montana that I cannot use in polite settings. It has to do with no, I won't do that.
Thank you.
So, it might help your understanding. You know, Min Koji wrote a letter to the Commissioner of Human Services, objecting to the methodology being used, objecting to the lateness of the product, asking why it's taken DHS from whenever the legislation was enacted in June, I think, till now to even decide what to do. That letter was sent by our chairman, Gary Hill, about a month ago. We've never received an answer from the Commissioner of Human Services. Okay? So, and I, frankly, in an email the other day to board members, I characterized that as colossal arrogance. So, you know, we're a government of laws and of the people, not a government of bureaucracy. At least we ought to be. So anyway, I'm sorry I pontificated some there, but... I appreciate what you're trying to do, and to the extent what I do is helpful to you, thank you. And if it's not, tell me. So.
Any questions or comments for Mr. Gamberling? All right. Thank you very much. Any additional questions of our testifiers? All right. Well, then, we only have one meeting left. It will be Monday, the 22nd, at 10 a.m., not 9 a.m., and we'll have a presentation from Mr. Gehring on what some other states are doing in this area. And then the committee also has the authority to make recommendations to the legislature. We've visited a variety of topics, from body cams to LPR to bulk data. This today, if anybody on the commission is interested in making recommendations to the legislature, providing direction to any of the agencies, our last chance before session starts to do that would be on Monday. I would be open to putting any type of proposal or discussion on the agenda for next Monday, but it would be helpful to have something in writing ahead of time. I know it's a short time frame, so please email me or call if you are interested in making any formal recommendations on Monday. Any questions regarding that? Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, could you tell me or remind me the timeline of this commission? Does it deadline itself somewhere, or does it continue?
Our terms will expire at the end of the year. Then the Speaker and the leader in the Senate will have the duty to reappoint members. The gavel will go to the Senate for the next two-year term.
All right. I was just wondering if this was a temporary commission or if it was something that was intended by last year's legislature to continue on an ongoing basis.
This commission will go on an ongoing basis. It is my hope
that
2017, I guess, we're good till. But it is my hope that those that have participated to this point will ask to be reappointed. As you can tell, there's many issues. They're complex. They build upon each other, are related to each other. I think we've done some basic laying some foundation here in some issue areas that at least in some believe need some attention. So certainly recommendations could come out of a similar group in January, February, or March as well.
Right.
Anything else? With that, we're adjourned. Oh,